This is The Europeans, the weekly podcast about European politics with some weird non-political stories thrown in just for fun. And my lovely co-host Dominic is back behind his microphone.
I am, and I've got a new microphone.
It's sounding sultry.
Thank you. I hope people can hear the difference. Yeah, we thought finally after 3 years it was time to upgrade my microphone. Thank you, Patreon supporters.
Treat yourself. Dominic, I actually want to start this week's episode with a low-key celebration. You know how last week I gave my bad week to book lovers in Slovakia?
Oh,
because
yeah.
The government had announced it was going to whack up the taxes on books because books are supposedly mostly enjoyed by rich people?
Yes.
Well, there's obviously been a huge backlash to this policy in Slovakia. And I think the finance minister, Ladislav Kamenický, must have heard us talking about it on this podcast because listener Arnold wrote in to flag up the fact that not only has Kamenický cancelled the planned tax rise, he's actually reducing the tax on books as well as the tax on newspapers and audiobooks. It's going from 10% to 5%. What a win.
That's quite a turnaround, but I think it's quite bold for you to take the praise for that U-turn.
Slovakia, you're welcome.
Well, the Dutch government weren't listening to your section because nothing's changed here.
Yeah, apparently not. You guys are still having your book taxes increased. Commiserations. Mm-hmm.
For now.
If you're a member of the Dutch government, you need to listen back to last week's episode.
Okay, I'll be sending it around as part of Katie's weird podcast lobbying operation, apparently.
Thank you. What are we talking about on the show this week, Dominic?
Well, later on in the show, our producer, Katz Laszlo, will be speaking to the Icelandic poet and writer, Andri Snær Magnason, about the unique challenge of telling stories about climate change. I cannot wait to hear what he's got to say. He's the author of this hit memoir on time and water that everyone around me has been reading over the last few years. So I'm so glad Katz got him to come and speak on the show. That's coming up later, but now it's time for Good Week, Bad Week.
Good week. Bad week.
Who has had a good week, Dominic?
I'm giving you a cheery good week. I'm giving good week to the turtles of the Mediterranean, who seem to have had a very good breeding season so far, according to two news reports I saw this week. The first was from the island of Zakynthos in Greece, home to a beach, Sicania, which is arguably the most important breeding area for loggerhead turtles, also known as Coretta Coretta. Yeah, they're so cute. They named them twice.
Coretta Coretta. Is that Shakira Shakira?
Yeah, it's just like that. There have been a record number of Coretta Coretta nests spotted in this National Marine Nature Park this year, and also a record number of turtles surviving after hatching. And now brace yourself, Katie, for a little bit of a depressing factoid. The rate of these turtles that survive from hatching to adult is extraordinarily low. The Mediterranean Association to Save the Turtles estimate that only 1 in every 1,000 hatchlings survives to adulthood.
Wow. Oh, that's so sad.
It is sad, isn't it? But the signs are that things are getting a bit better on that front, at least on this famous beach on Zakynthos, which is often referred to by conservationists as one of the most important maternity wards in the Mediterranean.
Cute. Tell me, are the turtle numbers bouncing back because of something that humans have actively done? Or are they bouncing back like in spite of all of the damage that humans have generally wreaked on their environment?
Well, I think first we should acknowledge the fact that the reason why these turtles were doing so badly was because of the humans in large part. This species of turtles has been around, they think, for 100 million years.
Wow.
And wind back to the beginning of the 1990s and they were close to extinction. Due to various reasons like fishing, boats, humans on beaches, development along beaches, all disturbing their delicate nesting moments. But yes, we can pat ourselves a bit on the back, or at least the conservationists can, because after this crisis in the early 90s, they did this amazing thing where they turned this very important beach into a marine nature park. And that led to strict zoning regulations, limiting where boats can go in the area, and strictly limiting where humans can be on the beaches during nesting season.
Mm-hmm.
Other things that have helped include removing artificial lights on the beach, as otherwise the turtles, when they hatch and make their momentous first journey towards the sea, hopefully, they end up waddling towards the artificial light and often away from the sea instead of towards the dawn sunlight sitting above the sea.
Oh.
If you're watching the series Bad Monkey on Apple at the moment, you might know that fact. It's a random thing that also comes up there, set in Florida. I don't know why I'm talking about. It's not European. The conservation effort is also helped these days by technology. There's actually CCTV on these beaches so that nests can be monitored and any potential animal predators or human trespassers can be spotted and dealt with in no time by one of the rangers without the rangers actually having to be there wandering around the beach in person all the time and disturbing the nests. So yeah, humans can be proud of themselves for fixing the mess that we made.
Good job, humans, for once.
For once. And actually, according to a report in The Guardian, conservationists have found over 1,200 nests on this beach this year, which means there is one for every 50 centimetre of beach, which is quite impressive, I think.
It sounds a bit like, you know, some of the most overcrowded beaches in Europe that have got too many tourists on them, on their little sunbeds.
There's also a housing crisis for the turtles. So this is one of two good news turtle stories from the Mediterranean this week. The other one I spotted was a report from Cyprus, actually from the British military bases on Cyprus, where the British military announced that both the loggerhead turtle, also known as...
Oh, was that the Coretta Coretta again?
Been listening. Yes, well done. You remembered. Also known as Coretta Coretta, and also the protected green turtle are making a comeback. They claim the nest count this year is up 25% on what was already a record count last year. Between 1994 and 2011, there were an average of 30 nests discovered each year on these military bases. And this year, they've spotted 382.
Nice.
So it's really great news. And it's definitely not propaganda for the British military's base that has been causing increasing controversy over the past year on the island of Cyprus. Definitely not.
You cynic. Wait, what's this controversy?
Well, first I should say, having sarcastically suggested that it might be propaganda, I don't actually think that the turtle facts aren't true. I believe that the turtle population is doing well on these beaches that are on military bases. It would actually make sense, seeing as there are strict restrictions on what you can build along these bits of coast due to the military presence. There are fewer tourists, and they've also got strict rules in place for anyone that has a barbecue on the beach or drives their vehicles or uses powerful lighting on the beach. You can actually end up with a fine of up to 17,000 euros or 3 years in jail.
Wow.
If you break those rules on one of the British bases in Cyprus. And I'm pleased that this law is helping the turtles, but I can't help but think that the British military base might be sharing this story out of a strategic wish for people to associate these cute, charismatic turtles with the military and to distract from the fact that these bases on Cyprus, which have been around since Cyprus gained independence from Britain in 1960, are controversial and increasingly controversial on the island, especially now at a time when there is growing discontent in Cyprus about the presence of the UK military, especially amid reports that the US military is also present in one way or another on the UK base, and especially considering Cyprus's proximity to the Middle East, which has seen a huge amount of military violence in the past year. Israel was attacked by Iran this week. Meanwhile, Israel is bombing Gaza, Lebanon, Syria, and Yemen.
Do we know if these bases are actually being used to help Israel?
Yeah, well, that's the big question, and it's kind of difficult to get a clear answer. I think the answer is yes, in one way or another, the bases are being used to help Israel. But the UK claim that no Royal Air Force flights have transported lethal cargo to the Israeli Defence Forces. That statement doesn't say anything about what the US planes that have been spotted there are doing. So there's quite a lot that isn't clear about the use of the bases and their collaboration with their US and Israeli allies. And there were actually protests just this weekend outside one of the bases, a base called Akrotiri. And I read in Reuters that the protesters were accusing the UK army of providing tacit support for Israel's operations in Gaza and elsewhere. But hey, guys, at least the turtles are doing okay.
Right? No, it's so interesting because I feel like there is a long history of various militaries around the world posting pictures on social media of like soldiers cuddling stray kittens. And they always do really well and get loads and loads of reposts because, you know, the contrast of this macho image and this act of caring, it's so obvious.
Mm-hmm.
I never really thought about it in terms of being active propaganda of like, look, we're a nice military. I clearly need to be much more cynical about the world.
Well, did you know that the Ministry of Defence in the UK actually has a magazine that they put out each year, which outlines all the amazing things to do with sustainability that are happening on military sites?
Sounds like a great read.
It's called Sanctuary Magazine. You can now get it only online. They used to print it, but they don't anymore.
Not very sustainable.
Indeed. And going back to the turtles for a minute, I feel I should add like quite an important caveat to this story, another caveat. And that is the irony that obviously a lot of what the British military is doing is broadly not good for the environment or biodiversity or for general ecology. I think that's, no one's going to argue with that. Even if we just stick with like the environmental impact of the British Army in Cyprus, it's not all rosy. There is a local charity on Cyprus called Bird Life Cyprus who have a project called Akrotiri Peninsula SOS and are very concerned about mismanagement of on-the-ground conservation and the protection of rare flora and fauna that isn't turtles.
Only you could turn this cute, cuddly story about turtles into a really depressing story about the military. It's, Dominic, you've done
true.
It again.
Katie actually sent me this story and was like, oh, look, you can talk about something nice. We can talk about something other than the far right, because honestly, we're all having a bit of far right fatigue at the moment, especially with the results in Austria this weekend. Yeah. So we decided to talk about turtles.
This was going to be a happy ending option.
I know. Well, you're welcome. I'd also like to thank my friend Thomas Seymour Evans, who gave me some vital background information whilst I was researching this Good Week segment. He's currently writing a book about militarized environments, published by the Bodley Head, and he's full of interesting stories about the relationship of the military with the land. So I'll try and persuade him to come onto the show once the book is out and written.
That'd be great. Finish the book, Tom.
Who's had a bad week, Katie?
Well, as you mentioned, the obvious thing to talk about this week would be the Austrian elections, the latest in Europe to be won by a far-right party. But as you say, Dominic, we're all getting, frankly, a little bit fatigued of talking about these far-right victories week after week. And I'm guessing you guys are a bit tired of hearing about it too. I'm also not sure how much we solve by talking about it every single week. So I think we could do with a little bit of a break from this important but miserable topic.
And instead,
I am actually going to give you a story that involves a far-right politician.
Oh, great.
But, it's not really so much about his politics as much as it is about him being an incredibly shady character. So bear with me. This is a story worth hearing. I'm giving bad week this week to Jörg Dornau. He is a German politician from the far-right AfD. He's a member of the state parliament in Saxony, but that is just his side gig. In his day job, he is an onion tycoon.
What?
Isn't that a great thing to have on your business card? Can you imagine? Katie Lee, onion tycoon.
Does he describe himself as an onion tycoon?
I haven't seen his business cards. I'll have to check. Anyway, until this year, the only business that Dornau had disclosed as a member of the parliament of Saxony was his agricultural business in Germany itself. Then came an investigation by Die Welt newspaper, which revealed that Dornau's business empire is not just in Germany. He is actually the owner of a huge piece of land in Belarus. And when I say huge, I mean like almost so big that you cannot visualize it. It is more than 1,500 hectares, which is more than 2,000 football pitches.
What?
This piece of land is near the Belarusian city of Lida, which is not far from the border between Belarus and Lithuania. And the piece of land is being mostly used for onion farming, along with some other vegetables. And Dornau set up a company to run this farm in 2020, which you'll probably remember is right about when the authorities in Belarus were cracking down on these massive pro-democracy protests, just after Alexander Lukashenko claimed to have won a presidential election, which he had very clearly stolen. So apparently Dornau wasn't especially bothered by this crackdown because he set up a farm in Belarus right in the middle of it. But yeah, we've known about the farm itself for a few months, and Dornau actually had to pay a fine of more than 20,000 euros in August for failing to declare it as an elected official.
Okay, so we knew about the farm a few months ago, then why are we talking about it this week?
Well, what happened last week is that a new investigation was published, this time from a Belarusian opposition outlet. It's called Reform. And what that investigation claims is that not only did Dornau own this farm in Belarus, but on this farm, political prisoners who are being held behind bars in Belarus for their opposition to the regime have been put to work processing these onions. So these are pretty explosive allegations. Reform interviewed one of the prisoners, a man they called Andre, but his name has been changed to protect him. And Andre was like, oh yeah, the German guy. He came to visit in his German car with his German number plates, and he identified Dornau from a photo. The claim, and Dornau has yet to respond to it, is that as the owner of this farming business, he signed off on a deal with the local prison to have him send workers to the farm. Now, that in itself wouldn't necessarily be controversial. Plenty of countries, including Germany, have these schemes where prisoners can earn money, right? In Belarus, there are a couple of issues. The most glaring one being that the regime has locked up a hell of a lot of people over the past few years for incredibly small acts of dissent. Things like liking a critical post on social media, following the wrong channel on Telegram. Andre, the man who was interviewed for the investigation, he was himself spending 2 weeks behind bars for liking a social media post. And these kinds of sentences are something that Dornau presumably would have been aware of. You know, like even if it wasn't explicitly written into his contract with the prison, we are going to send you people to work on your farm who are in prison for horrifically unjust reasons. It is very well known that this is what the regime has been doing, and also that people are still being locked up in Belarus for political dissent. There's also the fact that these people are well known to be treated abysmally in custody. This is how the Reform investigation put it. They wrote, as a reminder, special conditions are created for quote-unquote politicals in detention cells. Mattresses, pillows, and bedding are taken away. It is forbidden to sit or lie on the beds. Detainees are deprived of all packages. Light in the cell is on 24/7, and they are woken up several times at night. Most cells do not have toilets or sinks, only a plastic bucket in the corner, which must be emptied into a shared restroom in the hallway each morning. Our interviewee, Andre, calls these conditions torturous.
Terrible.
The working conditions on the farm itself, by the way, also don't sound great. The prisoners had to work from the early morning until 6 p.m. with no food or drink. They were reportedly paid about 5 euros a day each, and it isn't even clear to me from the reporting whether they were allowed to keep that money or whether they were supposed to hand it over to the prison. Because that's the other great thing about prison in Belarus. You're supposed to pay for your bed and board while you're in there.
That's so mad. Surely Jörg Dornau is not going to survive this news story. I mean, it's like as bad as it can get, really.
You would think. I mean, he himself hasn't yet responded at the time of recording. And most of his party colleagues have stayed mysteriously quiet. The one big exception is this guy called Hans Thomas Tilschneider, who belongs to the same faction of the AfD as Dornau. It's a group called The Wing, and it is considered to be the most radical pro-Russian part of the AfD. Tilschneider said there is nothing wrong with Dornau employing prisoners in Belarus, if that's what's legal in Belarus. And he called for people to show solidarity with this poor politician in the face of what is very clearly a smear campaign. So we should feel sorry for him, apparently. A spokesman for the AfD in Dornau's home state did tell Politico that he would be presumed innocent until there was, quote, full legal clarification. And that's the big question. Has he actually broken the law? It actually seems kind of unclear right now. But given that there have been successive waves of EU sanctions against Lukashenko's regime for human rights abuses, and also because of the regime's role in supporting Putin in the war in Ukraine, you would think that this is possibly in breach of some law or a sanctions package for a German politician to be merrily employing political prisoners in Belarus for 5 euros a day. But I don't actually have an answer yet to that question of whether or not he broke the law. I do think it is interesting that Dornau has complained about the sanctions on Belarus previously and described Germany as, quote, missing an economic opportunity in a country that lies in the middle of the new Silk Road. And he's made no particular secret of his links with the regime in Belarus. He's been photographed in Belarusian state media next to government officials, for example.
So it's really, really depressing, but I guess it's not that surprising that a politician from the AfD would have some kind of connection to Belarus.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, a lot of the party is quite pro-Russian, right?
Indeed,
and
yeah.
If you're pro-Russian, you're pro-Belarus generally.
Which is really interesting because in its original packaging as a Eurosceptic party, the AfD wasn't especially anti-Western or pro-Russian at the beginning. But as the years have gone on and the demographic of both its voters and its politicians have shifted, they have become more and more overtly pro-Putin and by extension, I guess, pro-Lukashenko because he is one of Putin's biggest cronies internationally. There have been allegations for years that the AfD have been financially propped up by the Kremlin, which incidentally is not actually that dissimilar from the financial story of the Pens party here in France. And there are also these historically closed links between East Germany, which is the AfD's power base, and Russia. They were communist allies once upon a time. And there have been studies done in Eastern Germany suggesting that a lot of voters there admire authoritarian leadership as something that brings safety in a turbulent world, which historians interpret as being a bit of a kind of cultural hangover from the communist years. But yeah, as I hinted at a second ago, the alleged financial support from Moscow to the AfD may also have played some kind of a role in all of the nice things that AfD politicians have said about Russia and not wanting to support Ukraine. It's kind of interesting, isn't it? The AfD call themselves a patriotic party and the only party that's truly looking out for Germany. But they're quite happy to take money from foreign regimes, it seems.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, it's still very unclear how this scandal is going to play out and whether Dornau is going to face political consequences or even criminal ones over this farm in Belarus. I do hope, at the very least, that the scandal brings a bit more attention to what's been happening in Belarus. Because other stories have come along to grab the news agenda since 2020, as they do. But the repression by the Lukashenko regime has gone on and on and on. Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, the opposition leader, is still being forced to live in exile. There are still an estimated 1,400 political prisoners being held in Belarus, and new people getting locked up all the time just for things like liking a post. So I do hope the situation there gets a bit more attention as a result of these revelations about Jörg Dornau. You might remember that a couple of years ago, we made an episode with the Belarusian poet Hala Komar about her own experience of being held as a political prisoner. And if you don't know where to start with understanding the situation in Belarus, I think that episode is actually a very human place to start. So I will drop a link to that in the show notes.
I agree. It's an amazing episode. Well, that was our good week, bad week without as much far right as normal, was it?
I mean, there was a smidgen less than usual and more turtles.
We need to try harder. This show has almost survived 7 years, right?
Oh my God, we're coming up to the 7th anniversary. Whoa.
Which is really something for an independent podcast with no backing from a major network. And it's honestly only the case because of our lovely listeners who support us out of the goodness of their own hearts voluntarily. We could not do it without you. And we are surviving, but we are surviving. We would love to be thriving. And the only way a show like this can thrive is if more listeners are willing to dig into their pockets and help us out. And a few people did this week. So thank you so much to the people that signed up on patreon.com. Would you like to say their names as a small thank you, Katie?
Well, I'm about to mispronounce a bunch of these people's names, so it's not a great thank you, but I'll do my best. Huge thanks this week go to Tyder, Katrina, Matthias, and Paul.
Thank you all so much.
So we are joined for this week's interview segment by producer Katz Laszlo. Hi, Katz. What are you doing here?
Well, as you said, I did this week's interview. I was lucky enough to talk to Icelandic poet and writer Andri Snær Magnusson.
And why did you want to talk to him so much? Because I know he's been on your dream interview list for a while now.
Yeah, so as you know, I used to teach about climate change and then I've been reporting about climate change for a long time. And there's this sort of pervasive story that it's hard to tell a story or to feel anything about climate change. Like it's too intangible or invisible or it's too far in the future. And I mean, I recognize the struggle, but I don't totally buy it. Like, forest fires and floods are happening now. They're like biblically dramatic. They're very tangible. And I think we're also just in a different moment now. Like, every summer shows us this is happening now.
Yeah.
But I think we're still struggling to figure out how to talk about these huge concepts of like time and climate. And I figured there must be some people out there who are good at telling these stories, stories that really make us feel something. And of course there are. One of those people is Andris Neer Magnusson. As you said, I've been following his work for a while, but I stumbled upon him again last week because he was in a documentary.
And you said that this documentary made you cry within like 20 seconds or something?
24.
24, sorry.
It was crazy. I mean, like, I've thought about this subject a lot, but so it was on Emergence magazine, and they have a series of four documentaries about the land. And this was episode 3. I won't ruin it. I'll just tell you to go and watch it. But it really went straight to my bones. And so I decided this week to ring him up and learn a little bit more about why it's generally so hard to understand these huge changes happening to our planet and how he has learned to tell good stories, good enough that they make me cry in 24 seconds.
Well, I can't wait to hear it. Here is Katz speaking to Andris Neer Magnusson.
Hello.
Nice to meet you.
Lovely that I can speak to you today. How and why did you start telling stories about climate change?
In 2006, I did a book called Dreamland, a self-help manual for a frightened nation. It did very well. It sold like 23,000 copies in Iceland. So then I met a climate scientist in Potsdam, and he asked me, why don't you write about climate change? And that was probably 2012. The real collapse of the glaciers in Iceland doesn't start until around the year 2000. So up till then, they were kind of sometimes growing, sometimes losing. A sequence of total loss has now been for more than 20 years. That was relevant because my grandparents were founding partners of the Icelandic Glacial Research Society. Mm. So glaciers had always been part of my family history and the legends of the grandparents. And basically their home was just full of pictures. And maybe the most epic trip was the honeymoon trip in 1956, the day after they got married, for a 3-week trip. And they were in a 2-person tent and they were snowed in for like 3 days. That place is called the Bride's Belly because nobody had been there, so they needed a name for it. And that's why this 13th highest peak in Iceland is called Brúðarbunga, the Bride's Belly.
That's a fantastic legacy already. And it's not even, you haven't even started your life yet.
Yeah.
It feels like we're in a different chapter now. It feels like we can see it, like we can feel it. But still we're struggling to tell stories about it, and not everybody can feel it. And I'm wondering why you think that we're struggling to tell stories and feel emotions about climate change.
In my studies, when I was looking for the stories to tell, my conclusion was that the issue is in a way larger than language, that language almost collapses because the words don't really convey what is happening. So if I say, for example, in the year 2100, we expect the pH level of the world oceans to have dropped from 8.1 to 7.7. And this is the greatest change in the world oceans for 50 million years. So I say that. Every single word that I said is meaningless. Hmm. It's difficult to grasp how big 8.1 to 7.7 actually is. 50 million years, it's just a gazillion. And 2100 is culturally also, strangely, almost like an unclaimed space, because the year 2000 was so heavily culturally coded in the mind and the imagination of a generation that I feel like it was almost harmful. It's like we can't really imagine past it. And I've often asked a group of people, do you believe 1970 was 30 years ago? And they say, yes, of course. And I think really subconsciously, many people talking about the year 2050, they feel like it's always 50 years into the future.
I really recognize that.
So I had to decide 2100 is meaningless. And I can't use science that points to 2100 until I create meaning. So there, of course, my grandmother came to use because she became 98. She would have been 100 this summer. So my metaphor was the black hole, that you can't look straight into the black hole. And just saying 2100 was like looking into the black hole. To understand the black hole, you look at the periphery. You look at the neighboring stars and galaxies. So to understand 2100, I go and visit my grandmother. To understand science, I use mythology. To be rational, I use poetry. And to be global, I am personal. So I always go the opposite directions. And so I take my daughter, we visit my grandmother, and we calculate, when do you become as old as grandmother? And that is in the year 2104.
Wow.
And you'll be an old lady, as cool as grandmother, fully loaded with life and experience and stories and love and descendants and just everything that a 98-year-old has. So you'll sit in this kitchen, fully loaded, making pancakes, and somebody comes, maybe not even a child, maybe somebody 24 years old, you know, somebody that you will have deeply influenced, not only as an infant, but basically into becoming a beautiful, mature human being. So that person, when is that person still talking about you as her greatest influence in life? And my daughter does the calculation, and she's like, wow, 2170. So all our glaciers are basically gone in the data before 2170. Now, if I say 2100, instead of being beyond our imagination, it's only halfway. So by trying to use very simple methods of storytelling to bring things that are abstract, distant, into kind of our intimate space of responsibility.
Why do you think it's important that we don't just think about climate change or about our planet changing? I think climate change is almost like an anti-word now because we don't feel anything because we hear it all the time. But why do you think it's important that we don't just think about how the landscape around us is changing, but that we really feel it?
Like you were talking about the word climate change, because when I told my friends I was going to write about climate change, they were like, oh, I could see how their eyes rolled. But when I told them that I'm writing about time and water, then they were, wow, that's interesting. What do you mean?
Mm.
Basically, scientists predict that every single element of water on our planet is simultaneously being disrupted. That is the glaciers, the sea levels, the pH of the oceans, the permafrost, the weather systems, the snow caps, the ice caps, every single element of water that we have, the rain, the snow, everything that we have relied on and aligned our civilization is simultaneously going out of balance. And that means this will move possibly billions of people.
Yeah.
And my friends were like, whoa, that's serious. And I said, yes, it's very serious. It's sometimes called climate change. And then I asked them, like, do you understand climate change? And they say, yes, of course. And I was like, okay, do you believe that climate change is bigger than, for example, the coronavirus? And I said, yes, of course. And name me like the top 10 things that you sacrificed for Corona. And they could go like endlessly, like, you know, didn't go to movies, didn't hug grandmother, didn't party, didn't celebrate this and that, lost this work opportunity, you know, like basically you could talk endlessly about the sacrifice. And then I say, okay, name me the top 10 things you have sacrificed for climate change. And they're like, wow, yeah, that's a good question. I'm like, okay, I don't have all day. Just give me the top 10. It must be a lot because it's much more than Corona. And then they were like, well, I don't use plastic straws anymore. Okay, that's radical. And then they're like, well, my uncle, he bought a Tesla. And I'm like, okay, that's sacrifice.
I'm wondering because a lot of what you're saying is not new in the sense that, like, we have known about the data for a long time, but policymakers, journalists, scientists have struggled to make people feel it. Do you have any advice on how to learn to talk about it in a way that engages with people's emotions?
My choice was to create my own vocabulary, but maybe I'm entitled because I'm a professional writer. I'm working in this space like full time, but I try to avoid things that people say too often. At least for my taste, the language becomes almost unbearable at the time. And you're just throwing chunks of rhetoric that has already been created. It's almost like we're ChatGPT. I can just start now. I can just start my own ChatGPT. We have to act now. We have 10 more years to stop climate change. We have to reduce emissions. So everything that I will say will be, you can't listen to this. I could not press this upon somebody. I would want to scream it, but that just makes you put up your guards. So what I saw was, just by saying grandmother, I saw that people's hearts opened. And then I could throw ocean acidification into that open open space there.
Into that open wound.
Into that open wound. But also like not taking frontal attacks and avoiding loaded rhetorics. We are in a paradigm shift. And when a paradigm shift happens, language collapses. You can expect confusion because all our norms are challenged. I was going through this history of paradigm shift in the Icelandic language, and it's very interesting to see that when women got the right to vote, how do you write in a language? Women were not included in language, and then they had to break into that language. And the language that I'm using, it's the 20th century language, industrial normalization of the destruction of species, the normalization of infinite energy. This book was written about climate change, but it's written in oil-normalized language.
Something that is as old as human time is stories. And you have said we are living in mythological times. How do you think mythology can help us prepare for the future?
Mythology is about the fundaments. Worlds are created, worlds end, or somebody is dragging the sun in a chariot over the sky. Now we are rattling the fundaments. That is, the world leaders are meeting to discuss the sea level. World leaders have never discussed the sea level before. You know, when did they meet? Okay, Moses, he was moving around with the sea level, but that was on a very tiny scale. And that was remembered for like 5,000 years. So how long will this be remembered when they're sitting in New York somewhere discussing the sea level? And they don't understand how fundamentally crazy that is, that they're just discussing the sea level and then they go for a cocktail. You know? but they're not like, and then they go home and then they go for a summer vacation. It's not like they understand what is happening and that we are in this situation where normally you would call out the National Guards, you will skip your summer vacation, you will deploy volunteers, you will put everybody in a uniform for a year and make them do something boring, you know, because we need to. You know, we normalize that for war, where you don't just do something boring, you do something really very destructive, actually. But we need to deploy resources towards a certain cause for a certain amount of time, but it's a certain disruption that has to take place.
Why? I mean, obviously, I've grown up in the world that we live in, so I do sort of understand it. But at the same time, I'm like, why is that? Why do you think we're not having a stronger reaction to this?
This is the first time we have to deal with something like this, maybe as a planetary human species. We have deployed nations for all sorts of emergencies that are in a local city. I got like this emergency call from my friend in the Amazon. Everything was burning around him. And it's very apocalyptic when you look at the floods in Kathmandu, everything. And then you ask, and I ask, and we ask, like, when does this wake-up call happen? When does this collective response take place?
I start to wonder if it really will be like that or if it'll look like something different.
Yeah.
You talked a bit about geological time. What do you mean when you say that the change happening is on a time scale that we can't really imagine?
A child born today, becoming as old as my mother, is witnessing a bigger change in the world oceans than not only all the ancestors of man, if we are 300,000 years old, all the ancestors of the Homo species, about 5 million years old, but 10 times the evolution of humanity being experienced on a single human being. This is a mythological era. We measure our age in how often we move around the sun. So we use geology to measure how old we are by how often we fly around the sun. If we would measure our age in the speed of glaciers, then I'm already like 500 years old.
Mm.
Or if we measure time in what would be a normal change in the pH of the world oceans, then I'm like 10 million years old already. Yeah, so basically if a single human being is seeing a greater change than you would expect would happen in 50 million years, that is nature leaving geological time and changing on a human scale.
Feeling all of this, like, at the same time as knowing that whatever happens, however much climate change we manage to mitigate as a species, we're facing enormous loss and change. And I'm wondering, like, what is the point of feeling all of this?
I do not really believe that we're totally crazy as humans. We're quite resilient in the end. We won't probably do anything until we have our backs against the wall. But I do think that change is possible. Like, all the paradigm shifts that I was talking about, they all did happen, you know, women's rights or democracy or all these things. And they all did through a similar pattern. They did through protests and strikes and talks and talks and talks and talks and talks. So now I did not have the expectations that I would write the magic book that would fix climate change. But I think I am one of millions that add to this until we reach that tipping point. So if we're going to reach zero in 2050, then it basically means that this generation of 1 or 2 billion young people is also a tectonic force. If that generation has values, if they really are connected to this century in a meaningful way, then quite a lot can actually happen in a rather short time. If you redesign transportation, aviation, food production, clothes, we need all hands on deck and all the talent to solve this. And also to understand, never in history has change like this just gone smoothly.
Climate change is obviously not the jolliest subject, but I had a lot of fun talking to Andri, and it also gave me some space for the grief and the confusion and the numbness. And I found that really relieving because it made me feel less alone, like a togetherness. And one of the most beautiful and succinct examples I've seen of how Andri's writing can do that is in 2019, Iceland actually held a funeral for its first glacier to be declared dead by a scientist, Glacier Ok.
I remember that.
Yeah, and Andri actually wrote the plaque for the memorial. Mm-hmm. And the plaque reads, "A letter to the future. Ok is the first Icelandic glacier to lose its status as a glacier. In the next 200 years, all our glaciers are expected to follow the same path. This monument is to acknowledge that we know what is happening and we know what needs to be done. Only you know if we did it. August 2019, 415 parts per million carbon dioxide." Mm. Yeah, I think that just those few sentences touch me so much more than data can. And I'm very glad that people like Andri have found a way to talk about this. As I said at the beginning, this documentary I watched was really excellent. If you liked what you heard today, I strongly recommend you go and watch it. There will be a link in the show notes.
I can't wait to watch it. And I'm also definitely adding On Time Awards to my reading list straight away. Thank you so much, Kat.
You're most welcome.
It's time to hit the Inspiration Station. Dominic, what have you been enjoying recently?
You sound so excited about entering the Inspiration Station. It's time to join the Inspiration Station.
I am excited.
Okay, good. Okay, well, if you're excited, then I'll tell you about a book that I read recently by the British author Linda Grant. It's called When I Lived in Modern Times. And it's a novel set in Tel Aviv just after the Second World War. The story is told through the eyes of a British Jewish beautician who moves to Palestine in the search of a new life for herself. But it's also more broadly a kind of portrait of Tel Aviv during this huge transitional moment in history just before the state of Israel is formed. There is so much about the history of Israel and Palestine that I don't know enough about, that I feel really underinformed about. And I found this book to be really informative as well as engaging and a good read. So I really recommend it if you too would like to know more about this moment in history post-1945. Whilst we in 2024 are living through one of the most disturbing periods of history in the same region. So it's called When I Lived in Modern Times. It was published in the year 2000. So once again, I'm not exactly offering a cutting edge piece of culture, but we don't all need to just read books that have only just come out, do we?
No, sometimes it's nice to dig up old treasures. And that sounds like a really good option. I often think fiction is a great way to learn about the real world.
Yeah, me too. I mean, obviously, I have to take everything with a pinch of salt and realize that it is just fiction. But no, I found it really interesting. What have you been enjoying, Katie?
Well, ever since I asked our listeners for recommendations for the best things they enjoyed over the summer, I have been dying to watch the Irish film Kneecap, but I've given up on my prospects of being able to watch it anytime soon here in France. So I thought I'd recommend it on behalf of the numerous listeners who said it was the best thing they'd watched in ages. Have you heard about Kneecap?
No, I haven't. Tell me about it.
So it's a film about a real life hip hop group called Kneecap. They are from Belfast in Northern Ireland, and they rap in English, but also in Irish. They've been growing a kind of cult following in both Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland for the past few years now. And the film is a comedy about the band's origin story. Very unusually, the band members play themselves. They're not played by actors. They had to get taught how to act for the film. One of the members, DJ Provy, has joked that the only reason they're in it is that Paul Mescal was sadly unavailable. Michael Fassbender is in it, though, as one of their dads. And apparently this film is very, very funny, very chaotic. There's lots of sex and drugs. It's drawn a lot of comparisons to Trainspotting already. Although stylistically, the director said he wanted it to look a lot like the French movie Amelie, which is not very gritty at all. It's a very whimsical kind of film. And it is about the politics of language and how the Irish language was suppressed under British rule. One of our listeners, Mary, said that she particularly enjoyed it as someone who is learning Irish at the moment, but she also said it had great characters and great music. It's been a bit of a film festival sensation in recent months, Kneecap, and it's being talked about as a strong contender for the Oscars. So if it is coming to your country soon, unlike mine, I recommend checking it out.
This film makes me think of these Irish kids that went viral over the summer. Did you see that video of the Irish kids rapping that song? I was obsessed with it.
That song went viral just after we went on our summer break, and I was really sad that we never got to play it. So can we play it now?
Yeah, let's do it. It's called The Spark.
Such a banger.
Yeah, it was part of a youth rap initiative in Cork. Those kids are so talented. So for my happy ending today, I've got a cheering story that was shared with me by two listeners and supporters of the show. Thank you, Stuart and Britta. It's the news that German residents have installed 500,000 small solar panels on balconies in the past few years.
500,000. That's amazing.
500,000. It's part of a movement which is known as Balkonkraftwerk. And
of course, there's a German word for this.
Of course. And the really nice thing about this is that unlike with big solar panels that need huge roof spaces, this trend involves small panels that can fit on small balconies. Of course, because the solar panels are small, they also don't generate a huge amount of electricity. But depending on how big the panels are and how many you've got and how much sun they can get on your balcony, they really can make a difference. And the investment should be paid off eventually, even if it takes a number of years. The popularity is thanks to a combination of local and federal regulations that improve access to these panels. And whilst these balcony solar panels are not going to fix the climate crisis alone, they do give people the chance to do something to try and help reduce their household emissions. And the thing I really like about these solar panels is that they are available for people who rent houses. Ah. So many solar panels are only an option for homeowners, and I really liked that about this story. So I'm pleased that some renters can also benefit from modest savings on their energy bills. If you're interested in the pros and cons of the Balkonkraftwerk movement, then I'll link to a story from Canary Media in the show notes called How Germany Outfitted 500,000 Balconies with Solar Panels. Hope it leaves you happy.
We are away next week, which is sad, but it's also quite well timed because I am disgustingly ill. So I'm hoping this is going to give me a bit of time to recover and come back with a nicer, less croaky voice.
I hope so too. My sickness has also lingered. It's a nasty one at the moment.
Well, I don't think anyone should expect me to get better soon because my baby just had a creche, so I'm going to have a cold for the rest of the year. I hope you like the sound of sneezy women, listeners.
It's quite a good name for a podcast.
Sneezy Women?
Yeah.
Let's make it. We'll be back the week after next. While we're away, come befriend us on the internet. We're on Instagram and various other social media platforms that are kind of semi-dead. Oh, we're also on Mastodon, which is a lot smaller, but it's very nice.
This week's episode was produced by Morgan Childs and Kat Laszlo. Thank you both.
Adieu.
Bye-bye.